everybody, it's Rich. Welcome, or welcome back, to the Access Church Podcast. Hey, at the end of this episode, please take a moment to subscribe to our YouTube channel, where you'll find our complete Sunday experience with music, as well as great content for kids and students. Visit accesschurch.com to keep up with everything going on around here at Access, and subscribe to our email list. We'll send you helpful suggestions each week designed to help you make friends, grow in faith, and live with purpose. Most importantly, I hope the following presentation inspires you to take your next step in your faith journey. Enjoy.
You are a winner. Now, I know as soon as I say that, you're going to push back a little bit. You're going to say, oh no, I remember all the times that I've lost. But really, you are a winner. I know this about you. And I understand that immediately you start thinking about the times you've lost, because I remember getting, you know, picked last for dodgeball. I remember getting cut from the basketball team. I remember spending much of my elementary years wondering if I had a special talent and instead just feeling incredibly ordinary. But I know this about you. Without even knowing your name, I know that you are a winner. You see, there was once an event, and it's not exaggerating to say that this one event was the single most important event of, and you triumphed. Yeah, there was a race. There was a race with 300 million contestants, and you, my friend, you finished first. Now, to be fair, some of you tied, but still, first place, you know? And this was not an easy race to win. If we were to scale this race to the size that you are today, you began this race at a speed of 34,000 miles an hour. And you swam with all your might because your very life depended on it. You swam like the little champion that you are. And you knew that if you lost this race, you would die. So the stakes were high. But my friend, you won the race. Now, you began this race 1/20th to 1/30th the size of the head of a pin. And you still contained half of all the genetic code that you have today. And the other half of your genetic code was in your mother's egg, which was the size of a dot that a pen might make on a piece of paper. And when these two came together, they began to multiply at an incredible speed. And immediately, cells began to multiply and develop with a very specific cause and purpose. Some cells identified themselves as heart cells, others muscle cells, others bone and blood and skin and marrow and lung tissue. Your body immediately began to specialize, all based on the information contained in your DNA and epigenetic information, which honestly, biologists are still struggling to understand. But these cells began to multiply at a rate of up to 100,000 per second. The information contained in your DNA is so incredible. In fact, if we took all the books in all the languages of all the world and put all of those books into the language of DNA, all of those volumes would fit into something the size of 1/100th the head of a pin. That is the fascination of DNA. And DNA generates and creates this molecular machinery that is your body. In fact, biologists, they struggle to really describe the molecular machinery that goes on inside of us without using comparisons to machinery that we know in the real world. Let's just take the bacterial flagellum, okay? It's a little rotary motor inside your body. And if you took 35,000 of these and you put them end to end, they would fit in the space of 1 millimeter. They turn at 100,000 RPM. They can stop in a quarter of a turn and reverse at full speed. Now, all of this is happening while we're sitting here talking. And just in the space of time that I have been talking, your body has generated 25 million new cells every second. Are you doing that? No, know, you're not even aware that these miracles are happening inside your body as I speak. So if you're not directing this, who is? Who is? This is the question that has been bothering humanity since the beginning of time. Because as we look at the world around us, it seems too phenomenal to have not been designed. And so the question began with what started all of this? Because as we have written observations going as far back as Aristotle, the observations all record this pattern, which is that everything that has a beginning has a cause. And so if we go back into enough beginnings, eventually we must end up with an uncaused cause. And that uncaused cause is what we're going to talk about here today. David, the philosopher, the poet, 3,000 years ago, he wrote this down. He said, "For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well." Who was David addressing? Well, he was addressing, if nothing else, the uncaused cause. Now, the uncaused cause is at the beginning of everything, and the uncaused cause must exist outside of time, space, and matter. The uncaused cause cannot exist in nature because nature didn't exist when the uncaused cause created everything. Now, this created quite a conundrum for a lot of people, especially those who would rather exclude God from the equation. And so while Aristotle and those after him are theorizing about the uncaused cause, in about the 13th century, another group of people begin to say, what if we start with the conclusion? What if we begin with the conclusion that there is no God? If we exclude God from the scenario, then what are we left with? And then a theory developed that the universe was, in fact, eternal. Because if you expanded the universe to fill all of eternity, then that would solve one of the problems of design, which would simply be that now there's enough time for randomness and chance to introduce what we see today. And out of this philosophy and out of this thought process came a man named Darwin. And we have the Darwinian theory that was introduced in the mid-1800s, and modern scientists and modern thinkers began to say, yes, this gives us an explanation, and an eternal universe allows for this to take place over a great period of time. But then, in 1929, astronomers and physicists discovered that the universe was expanding, which was problematic. Because this means that the universe at some point had a beginning, and they introduced the theory of the Big Bang. Now, the Big Bang was originally a negative term that was used to dismiss the Big Bang, because for 30 years, scientists dismissed the Big Bang as a fringe theory, and it was 30 years before it started to catch on and before it became commonly accepted science. In fact, in today's language, some might have even said that the Big Bang originally was disinformation. But 30 years later, it became rather well accepted. Stephen Hawking writes this. Stephen Hawking estimates that if the expansion rate of the universe was different by one part in 100,000 million million, 1 second, after the Big Bang, the universe would have either collapsed back on itself or never developed galaxies. This is the precision built into the universe within the first second after the Big Bang. Another example of this incredible, incredible precision is the force of gravity. Gravity, we now know, has a margin of error of one in, well, it's this number right here. We don't have a word for this number. It's 40 zeros. I think I got that right. You guys can check my math, but I really carefully counted my zeros. And that's 40 zeros. Now, you might say, I can't comprehend a number this big, so let me put it into terms for you. This is how many inches wide our universe is. If you were to measure our universe in inches, it would be one with 40 zeros after it. The margin of error for gravity, for our universe to exist as it does, without planets just spinning off and no longer orbiting the sun, the margin of error is 1 inch on the scale of the universe. This is incredible. All of this points to the idea that there is not only an uncaused cause, but this uncaused cause might in fact be an intelligent designer. Now, I want to pause for a moment and just talk about the idea of intellectual honesty, because I think this is important when we have a conversation like this. I come into this conversation with a bias, and you should know this. I believe with all of my heart and all of my head that there is a God. And because of that bias, I am going to see things through a particular lens. And we call it a lens because we can't see it. We only see through it. And my request for you today would be to ask that you would recognize that you may also have a lens. Now, let me put it this way. Do you believe that all pastors, priests, and popes can be trusted? You should not. Do you believe that perhaps in the world of science, we see things through a lens, and that it's possible to believe in science without believing in a particular scientist? You see, if I heard your story, and you told me why you walked away from faith, I would probably agree. I would understand that you have been wronged at some point by someone along the way. And perhaps that was in the church. Perhaps that was by a pastor, priest, or pope. And you had very good reason for walking away because you saw hypocrisy. You saw inconsistency. You saw a pattern that didn't match up to the ideals. Maybe it's your next door neighbor who says he's a Christian, but clearly has not read the covenants of the HOA. Whatever your reason for walking away from faith, I get it. And if I heard your experience, I would probably agree with you. And if I lived your experience, I might have even followed the exact path that you have followed. But the reality is that walking away from faith doesn't make the underlying principles of the faith any less true or any more true. And so I want to be intellectually honest with you today and say that, you know what? You may be right. I believe what I believe based on faith. But it's not blind faith. And this series that Justin and I are doing over these few weeks is to ask the question, does my faith have a foundation in reason? Or is it just wishful thinking? And it's our belief and it's our intent to strengthen your faith, that your faith is not just based on blind faith, it's not just based on tradition, and it's not based on superstition. In fact, that there is no competition between faith and science, but in fact, that the two go together. So before we move into this conversation today, I would like to ask you to ask yourself the question, what am I searching for, really? You don't have to answer that out loud. You don't have to answer that to anyone else. But you deserve, you owe it to yourself to ask the question, what am I searching for, really? And am I on a truth quest or a happiness quest? Is your desire to know the truth, even if it makes you unhappy? Or have you determined what is going to make you happy, and you're looking for the truths of the universe to fit into your prescribed notion of happiness? In other words, another way to ask this would be, has the data informed my perspective? We're gonna get there. There we go. Or is my perspective informing my conclusion? We all know that those who deliver the news have a bias. I have a bias. You have a bias. Let's be aware of our lens as much as we possibly can and be honest about this. Let me give you an example from the world of law, okay? If you've ever served on jury duty, I've been lucky enough to have been on a jury duty twice. And if you've ever been lucky enough to serve on jury duty, you know that the role of the prosecuting attorney and the defense attorney is similar. They both are there to present the evidence and to provide a hypothesis that tells the story of how the evidence came to be. And your job as a juror is to determine if the evidence is believable and if the prosecution's case meets the very high standard of being beyond a reasonable doubt. Does their hypothesis meet this standard? So I'm gonna provide you with a little bit of data and let's see where we come as a jury. And we're gonna be a jury here together. So here is the question of reasonable doubt, all right? This is a case that we're just going to try to solve together. Okay, the blood of the defendant is found at the scene. The odds that this blood does not belong to the defendant are 1 in 170 million. That's your first bit of evidence. Next piece of evidence is blood was found on the defendant's socks. The DNA characteristics from this blood had a 1 in 9.7 billion chance of not being from one of the two victims. Third piece of data. Bloody footprints at the scene and in the defendant's car match a rare designer shoe pattern, of which only 299 pair were sold in the United States. One such pair was owned by the defendant. Fourth, the blood of both victims, as well as blood from the defendant, are found in the defendant's vehicle. Anybody there yet? Making some conclusions? See if this last piece of evidence helps you. A bloody left glove was found at the scene and contained bloodstains from both victims as well as the defendant. The matching right glove was found in the defendant's home. The defendant was known to wear that brand of gloves for 4 years leading up to the crime. Verdict? Would you be surprised to know that when surveys were done immediately after the trial of O.J. Simpson, that depending on people's life experiences, their background, their exposure to the police, their exposure to the justice system, their racial background, the neighborhood they lived in, 87% of some people surveyed said that the evidence points unequivocally to his guilt. And other surveys, 71% of the respondents said that the evidence showed without doubt that he was framed by a corrupt police department. You see, the evidence doesn't say anything. We must interpret the evidence, and we all interpret the evidence through a lens. Science doesn't say anything. Scientists do. That's not my goal here today, is not to argue with science. As I'll show in just a minute, I believe that science and faith go together hand in hand. But we have to walk into this like we walk into any conversation and recognize I have a bias, the people that I'm reading have a bias, the people that are presenting information have a bias, even my pastor has a bias. And I want to say to you today, you may be right, but we're asking the question here today, does my faith in God as an uncaused cause, is it built on wishful thinking or does it have some evidence? And how has this been presented to me most of my life? And what have I accepted perhaps without asking enough questions? One example comes from Richard Lewontin. And he's a zoologist and a evolutionary biologist from Harvard University. And he wrote this. He said, our willingness to accept, he's an atheist, but he said, our willingness to accept scientific claims that are against common sense is the key to an understanding of the real struggle between science and the supernatural. We take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs, in spite of its failure to fulfill many of its extravagant promises of health and life, In spite of the tolerances of the scientific community for unsubstantiated just-so stories, because we have a prior commitment to materialism. It is not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation of the phenomenal world, but on the contrary, that we are forced by our a priori adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations, no matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated. Moreover, that materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. Now, I appreciate that he's being honest about the lens through which he is seeing the data. But the question that we need to ask is, what if God does have his foot in the door? As an illustration here today, I brought this from home. I don't normally have it with me. You probably don't have one with you. But this is a great little example. By the way, this is an iPhone 12 mini. Don't get the mini. Just completely aside from the message today. Well, actually, it does bring up a point, which is that having a complaint about something it's not an argument against its existence. Just as a note, I'm dissatisfied with my iPhone mini. I think it's got some significant shortcomings, first of which is the battery life. I think I'm the only iPhone user that is confused and frustrated by the battery life. But my frustrations with this phone don't mean that the phone doesn't exist. It just means I don't like some things that are true about this phone. Okay, back to why I pulled this out of my pocket. The question I have for you, Steve Jobs introduced this wonderful device back in 2007. And so the question is, does this phone exist because of the laws of physics and electronics and matter? Or does this device exist because of Johnny Ives and Steve Jobs? The answer is both. You see, one is the science of operation. How does something operate in the known world? And the other is the science of origin. How did it come to be? And these two sciences are not in opposition to one another. In fact, they are very often necessary to one another. And so as we have this conversation, or as you have this conversation with your friends, or as you begin to wrestle with this for yourself, don't confuse the two sciences. There is the science of operation and there is the science of origin. And as we look at things that exist in the material world, we must ask both questions. How do they operate? Where did they come from? And if they come with a very specific design, does that mean that there might be a designer behind the process? Now, I'll give you an example from just nature, okay? If you were to make an observation of the Grand Canyon, you might very well come to the conclusion that nature is the author of the Grand Canyon. Everything that we see in the science of operation explains the Grand Canyon as we see it today. But if you were to travel just a little bit down the road, and you were to come across Mount Rushmore, and you were to draw the same conclusion about Mount Rushmore, I might say, come up a little short. Mount Rushmore calls for an observation of what's currently going on at Mount Rushmore and how the stone and the rock formations are surviving weather. But at some point, you have to step back from Mount Rushmore and look at that and say, there was an intelligent designer involved. So, again, I am not saying that God and science are competing explanations for the universe and life. I am not saying that. But I am saying that we must look at both the science of origin and the science of operation as we examine the evidence that is in front of us, and does it provide a good foundation for faith in an uncaused cause or faith in a God? Now, knowing how nature operates is not the same as knowing how nature originated. And for that, I'm going to look at two verses here before we move much further into this. And the first one, again, is from David, the psalmist. And he says this. He says, "The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands." That God can be seen in the skies, that God can be seen in nature, that God can be seen in the world around us. And then in Romans, Paul writes that for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. See, God authored two books. The first Justin spoke about last week. He talked about this book. For illustration, I always have to hold up my phone because this is where my Bible is most of the time. But this book, 66 different documents authored by 40 different people over more than 1,000 years, as phenomenal as this book is, it's not the only book that God has authored for us. He also authored the book of nature. And as these verses illustrate, just because you might have first learned about God at church does not mean that the idea of God's existence is only found in church or even originated in church. For thousands of years, human beings have been trying to understand the origins of the universe and the origins of humanity. One more example to talk about our lens and what shapes our thinking in this before we go into a couple of examples of the evidence that's in front of us. Albert Einstein is probably the most famous scientist of the 20th century. He is well known for his theory of relativity that he published in 1915. What is less known about Albert Einstein is that he wrote that when he first came up with the theory of relativity, that it pointed to a specific beginning of the universe. And this irritated him. That is the word he used. This irritated him. So he inserted a mathematical trick into the formula which would make the universe appear static and eternal. Time, space, and matter, static and eternal. He did not confess this for 14 years. And when he finally confessed it, it was because Hubble had discovered that the universe was expanding and therefore must have a beginning. So for 14 years, he continued to teach a mathematical formula that had been hijacked to say that the universe was eternal, that time, space, and matter were eternal. An astronomer and one of his biographers, Robert Jastrow, he writes in God and the Astronomers, I suppose that the idea of a beginning in time annoyed Einstein because of its theological implications. And Jastrow goes on to write this in a separate interview. He says, astronomers now find that they have painted themselves into a corner because they've proven by their own methods that the world began abruptly in an act of creation to which you can trace the seeds of every star, every planet, every living thing in this cosmos and on the earth. And they have found that all this happened as a product of forces they cannot hope to discover. That there are what I or anyone would call supernatural forces at work now, I think, is a scientifically proven fact. This is phenomenal. And this leads us into the first of just two points of evidence that I want to direct us to before we wrap up today. The first is what we call cosmological evidence. This is the idea that the very beginning of the universe argues for a God. In fact, Frank Turek, in Stealing from God, he says it this way. The greatest miracle in the Bible is the first verse. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. If that is true, then every other verse in the Bible is at least believable. Every other miracle, every other event, every other thing that is said or recorded is at least believable. If there was a God that created the universe from nothing, then anything else is possible. If the God of creation is possible, anything is possible. All right, let's look at some of the evidence. If time, space, and matter have a beginning, then the cause must transcend time, space, and matter. The cause can't be something natural because nature didn't exist. Further, this cause must be enormously powerful. This cause must be personal, with a will to choose to create. And so we are left with a spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, personal first cause. This is not evidence from the Bible. This is evidence from astronomy and philosophy. Now, let's hit the moral evidence, because I think that this argument is actually something that is deep within my heart and your heart as well. This is the idea that there is an ought to in the universe. This is the idea that there are some things that are good and there are some things that are bad. In fact, we would go a step further and we would say there are some things that are always good and there are some things that are always bad. And so we have to come to some philosophical laws of evidence for the moral evidence of the existence of God. And they start like this. Every law has a lawgiver. Look all the way back through history. Look all the way back through all the examples that you can bring to mind. Every law has a lawgiver. Now, the second one is where we might find a point of debate. There is an objective moral law. This is where you might pump the brakes a little bit. This is where you might push back. You might say, I don't believe that there is an objective moral law. But if you can think of even one thing, if you can think of even one crime that is always wrong, rape or murder or adultery, and you would say that is always wrong, you don't have to have all the laws. You just have to have one. If there is one moral objection that you have to behavior, then there is, by definition, an objective moral law. If there is not objective moral law, then all we are left with is your preference and my preference. If there is no objective law, then there is no justice. There is just my justice and your justice. If there's no objective moral law, then there is no injustice. There is no violation of human rights because there are no human rights. And so this becomes a very, very important question. Is there an objective moral law, even one? Is there something that is always right? Is there something that is always wrong? If so, therefore, there is an objective moral law giver. And by definition, moral laws are immaterial, meaning that they exist outside of time, space, and matter. And so again, the objective moral law giver must exist outside of time, space, and matter. Because the reality is this: morality is not made from molecules. Evolutionary biology says that survival is the ultimate good. Not sacrificing yourself for others, that is the opposite of survival of the fittest. To lay down your life for someone else would be the opposite of evolutionary biology. In fact, natural law is brutal and abusive. Without God, nothing has value. But because of God, and in the eyes of God, you have immeasurable worth because you have been ascribed worth by your creator, by the God who made you, who said that you are so valuable, he will give everything to be reconciled to you. You are made in his image, and this gives you immeasurable value. But that value isn't found in the natural or material world, it is only found from a supernatural God. You do not have to believe in God to know what is moral. This is really important. okay? I am not saying that you must believe in God to be a good person. We've all known people who say that they don't believe in God or they're uncertain of God and they're wonderful people. I know people like that. You know people like that. There is nothing that says that you cannot discover the moral law without knowing God. But you cannot determine the moral law without God. You do have to believe in God to judge what is moral. Does that make sense? That's a little bit of a brain stretcher right there. You have to kind of think about that one for a little while. If you're watching online, you might have to rewind, play that again. You do not need to believe in God to discover God's moral law, but you do need to believe in God to determine his moral law. Well, I wish we had time to go through all of the evidences for the existence of God. There are more. There is the teleological evidence. That's the evidence of the precision of the universe. There's evidence from reason, this idea that reason and logic itself exist outside of time, space, and matter. And so where does reason come from? How do we even argue philosophically without a God who's created the rules and the constructs of logic and reason? There's evidence from information. This incredible amount of information that is stored within the universe, within your DNA, and so many other places where God has stored information about the universe. From intentionality, this is the idea of free will. Oh, I wish we could just spend a whole day talking about this, but the very idea that you can choose anything is an immaterial idea. Because evolutionary biology says you are just a blob of protoplasm. And that every decision you make is hardwired into you. It is simply neurons that are firing and you're acting on that with no choice whatsoever. In fact, you don't have a mind, you don't have a self, you are just biology. But the argument from intentionality addresses that. From final causality, which this is fascinating, and again, so much more time you could spend on this, but final causality says that every cell in every being has a final cause, has a final purpose. That from the beginning of the multiplication of cells, these cells know what they're going to be. That as an embryo begins to develop, that embryo knows what it's going to be. And scientists, as much as they try to monkey around with an embryo and change its direction, change its path, can we even modify its species? It cannot be done. You only have three outcomes. You have a healthy embryo, a dead embryo, or a malformed embryo. But none of the cells redirect. They have a final causality. And then there's the argument from evil. And we're going to get into this a little bit over the next 2 weeks. And I would love for you to come back. Because the idea that there is a moral law in the universe means that there is such a thing as evil. If there is moral good, then there is moral wrong. And maybe one of the things that has frustrated you about faith or the existence of God is this question of why is there evil in the world? Believe it or not, evil in the world is not an argument against God. It's actually an argument for the existence of God. And over the next 2 Sundays, Justin and I are going to talk about God's solution for evil in the world. So you got to come back for these next couple of weeks. And finally, the arguments from science itself, which is really just all of these other evidences building upon themselves. So I want to finish today by asking you a very simple question. If the evidence were true, would you become a Christian? Are you willing to follow the evidence wherever it leads? And if the evidence is true, would you become a Christian? And if your answer to this is anything other than yes, my challenge to you would be, examine your lens. Are you on a truth quest? Or are you on a happiness quest? Sometimes when we're on a happiness quest, we have some complaints with God. But as I mentioned a minute ago with my phone, my complaints about my phone do not mean my phone doesn't exist. It means that I have some complaints. Are you on a truth quest or a happiness quest? Are you willing to examine your lens? Or maybe another way to ask the question would be this: what kind of God don't you believe in? And then I would challenge you, in light of that question, to begin to read the Gospels. Read the Bible, but specifically read the stories about Jesus. And you may find that the God that you don't believe in is the same God that Jesus didn't believe in. That the God that you don't believe in fact, doesn't exist in the Bible. You may have issues with faith, but you've never actually read the book. And I would say, again, in the interest of intellectual honesty, read the book. See who Jesus is. Understand the God that he talks about. And understand if that God is the God that you have issues with. Or perhaps if that God isn't the God that you're hoping exists. G.K. Chesterton said it best. He said, "The Christian ideal has not been tried and found wanting. It has been found difficult and left untried." Are you willing to give God a try? Let's pray. God, thank you so much for this truth. And I believe it's truth. But God, I pray that these evidences would provide a foundation of reason for our faith. God, I pray for all of us here in this room today, whether we are coming at this from a position of belief or a position of skepticism, that we would be willing to open our hearts at least and ask the question, are we willing to give God a try? We ask all of this in your name. Amen.